हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे रामा रामा हरे हरे। It's my great pleasure, my great honor to be with all of you this evening. Thank you for coming. Special gratitude to Sunil and Mataji Adarna for making this beautiful arrangement. Being Makara Sankranti, there are so many alternatives of what all of you could have done this evening. It's a great honor you came here. I didn't have any choice because I was scheduled to be here. Thank you so very much. I was asked to speak on the subject of integrity and compassion. If there are any two items which are absent, which really cause problems within the world we live, it is integrity and compassion. It's the basis of every spiritual path. It's the very basis of humanity. But unfortunately, in the world today, it's always been like this, but especially today. There are so many distractions, so many temptations, so many things to fear that can easily bring people to minimize the importance of integrity and compassion in their lives. And meetings like this evening are very significant because they help us to remind each other. As Sunil was explaining, the power of association has a great effect on how we see the world and how we act. I was recently remembering a story from this book that I wrote, The Journey Home. It took place in 1971. I was just about 20 years old. I arrived in India, I was 19, and I was traveling in Himalayas for some time. And I remember when I was in the Himalayas, this was January of 71. All the sadhus were inviting me to come with them to the Kumbh Mela at Prayag. And I had just hitchhiked from London to India, and I really liked the peace of living in the jungle. So I said, I'm happy to go, but tell me about it. And they said, about 25 million people will be there. So I decided to stay in my cave in the Himalayas. But I heard so many stories about the holiness of that place. And I was, in my heart, very eager to someday go there. Because I was studying a little later the Ramayana, and I read how Lord Ram, he declared that Prayag is Tirtharaj, the king of all holy places, the place where the Yamuna, the Ganga, and the Saraswati meet together. And so much history there. So I decided to go there. But it was the month of May. It was really hot summer. And I rode in third-class trains, which was kind of like the Indian way of hitchhiking, because it was free. Because in 1970, 71, there were no bars on the windows. So that means no matter how crowded the train was, you can jump through the window and get in. But if you wait for the train to stop, there's no possibility of getting in. So I went to the Prayag station, and I asked, where is the Sangam? And they told me, the Ganga is here, and then you go this way. So I went to Mother Ganga, and I didn't have shoes, because when I was in the Himalayas, I was living with some sadhus who really didn't believe in shoes. So I threw my shoes into the forest. So I was walking barefoot. The sand was literally like walking on fire. Have any of you ever walked on sand at noontime in the month of May in India? It was so hot. My feet were being blistered. In fact, every few minutes, I went into the Ganga, not for a holy bath, but just to cool my feet down. And I was walking and walking. It was pain, but I was trying to transform that pain, because what I learned from spiritual science is whatever the situation may be in our life, we could be depressed, or we can be arrogant, or we can be envious, or we can grow and take shelter of a higher power, just depending on how we view that situation. And we find that oftentimes in people's lives, spiritual transformation is foundational to suffering. Because usually we hear theoretically about spiritual things, but when we're really in an emergency, we sometimes take it seriously. I'm going to tell another story, then I'll get back to this story. I chant God's names every day for several hours. But the time that it's most difficult to really be attentive while chanting God's name, for me at least, is on international flights, airplanes. Because there's something about being up there 30,000 feet for so many hours that your mind kind of goes to sleep. At least mine does. So I'm just chanting and praying, reading. These alarms start going off. And then the announcement. The computerized navigation system of the whole plane, in fact, the operational system, broke down. So they were going to have an emergency landing in Mumbai, coming from London. And people were crying, and babies were crying, and people were really worried. Because they repeated this announcement every 5 minutes, about an hour and a half before the emergency landing. And even the airline hostesses, they're trained to keep everyone cool and confident, but their training didn't sustain their fear. They were trying to do that. But they were telling us you have to put your head between your legs, all these different instructions. And finally, we were getting close to Mumbai. And I looked down, and there was probably about 30 fire trucks and ambulances with their flashing lights on both sides of the runway. So it looked pretty serious. And I had just before been with somebody while he was dying. In Pennsylvania and America, I spent about 8 weeks with him. And people all over the world was praying for him. And I was thinking, there's a good chance I'm going to die. And nobody's praying for me. But I can tell you that hour and a half of my chanting, it was really good. It was attentive. I didn't fall asleep. It was serious. I was taking shelter. And something beautiful happened to me. First, it was very good chance of imminent death. And I felt God's presence so much because I was seeking God's presence with a sense of real necessity. And I felt so peaceful. And I wasn't thinking, am I going to live or die anymore? I was just praying for everyone. I was praying for all my deceased forefathers and foremothers, and I was praying for my parents, and I was praying for my family, I was praying for all my friends, and I was praying for all the devotees that I know here in India and all over the world, and I was praying for all humanity, and I was praying for all living beings, and it was just coming so much from my heart. God, please bless everyone and everyone and everyone, and it was blissful. And then suddenly the plane hit the runway at about 200 miles an hour or something, and it went up and down and was bouncing and bouncing, and you could hear all the luggage down and below us and above us going everywhere, and it really appeared we were going to die. It took about 6 or 7 huge bounces, and there was this rubber burning, and finally we stopped. And then we were surrounded by fire engines with their hoses out. And they said, we can't move because it could go on fire. And airplanes going on fire are not so safe. And after about a half hour of just sitting in the airport with all the hoses and fire trucks, it started moving. And the person said, or the pilot said, we're very, very sorry for the difficulties you endured, but sometimes this happens in the aviation industry. But we are very hopeful that next time you fly, you choose to fly British Airways. And believe it or not, after that, I always fly British Airways because it was the most spiritual experience I ever had on an airplane before. So sometimes we can interpret things in different ways, and we can either grow or we can shrink according to that. And this is very much the secret of success for people in all fields of life, is how to take even challenges and transform them into strengths. Not to give up. So here I was, my feet were burning in the sand. And I was, more than anything else, I was really eager to get to that confluence so I didn't have to walk in the sand again. But I was trying to get a lesson from it. And I think I walked about 2 hours, and I saw the Yamuna coming down to meet the Ganga. And because it was summer afternoon, nobody was there. Usually Prayag, at the confluence, a lot of people are there. But nobody was there. Except me. There's a saying, something about mad dogs and everything being out. I was crazy. So I was there, and I put my passport and my little bag down to go in the water. And here I was, after such a long time of yearning to be in this place. I felt so blessed. And that suffering of having my feet burning just made the experience so much more special when I actually arrived there. Because the more we really yearn for something and feel the value of it, the more we can appreciate it. things that come cheaply, we don't give much value to it. So I went in the water. I was so happy. And then I was thinking, I want to stay in the water as long as possible, because I didn't want to go back in the sand, actually. And so I decided to swim all the way across to the other side. And on the other side, in those days, there was nothing and nobody around. So I swam with the current of the Ganga across the Yamuna, and I reached the other side, and I was really exhausted, because I'm not a good swimmer, but I swam. And when I finally got there, I decided to rest in the sand. And as soon as I put my foot in the sand, I started sinking. I was being sucked down. It was quicksand. And I was thinking, maybe this is because I'm close to the water. So I somehow or other took a few steps further from the water, and I was sinking even faster. And that was the first time. I'm from Chicago. There's no quicksand in Chicago. I was just going down quite rapidly until I was about to my knees. And the sun was burning. And there was nobody within miles and miles and miles around. There was no cell phones in those days. And the more I was struggling to get out, the faster I sunk. And I saw a thorn bush, and I grabbed onto that thorn bush, and I was trying to pull myself out. It was the only bush in that quicksand. My hands were bleeding, and I pulled really hard, and the bush from its roots came out. So now I had nothing to hold on to. So I understood I was going to die, and there's nobody who could help me. So I decided, there's no use struggling because it's not helping. I can't get out. So I just decided to relax and just give myself to God. And when I relaxed, I just kind of laid back. And I saw when I wasn't struggling to get out, I was actually floating. Quicksand, you don't really go down unless you try to get out of it. I didn't know that, but I discovered. So I just laid back and really slowly, slowly, slowly could lift my legs up. And then really slowly I crawled on my stomach to the river and got in the river. And that's another story, because I had to go against the current of the Ganges, and the Ganges was pushing me back to the quicksand. And ultimately, I was drowning because I was swimming against a very powerful current. And I was going as hard as I could, but Mother Ganga was pushing me backwards. And finally, a boatman, an old boatman with a big red turban, started coming by. And I was screaming out to him because he was a little distance away, trying to get his attention, but he didn't hear me. And I was going, help, help, help. And finally he looked at me, and I thought, God is still with me. And he just looked at me and went like this, and then just floated by and left me there to drown. And I went underwater, and again, I thought, let me just give my heart to God, because now I'd rather drown in the Ganges than get sucked into quicksand. So as I was drowning, I had heard the Maha Mantra, this Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. in the Ganges about 6 months before. So now that I was underwater in the Ganges, that mantra came back into my heart, and I started just chanting it in my mind. And just by chanting that mantra, I got some clarity. Why did that old boatman go like that? He was telling me, don't swim across the Ganges. You can't swim against it. It's too powerful. Swim with the Jamuna, the other way. I never thought of that. So the Ganges pushing me this way, the quicksand's here, so I swam that way for about a kilometer before I can get. And finally, about 6 hours later, I got to where I left my passport. And believe it or not, there was hundreds and hundreds of people bathing there then, because it was now the evening, the sun had already set. And my passport was sitting right there with my little bag. Nobody even touched it. So I was happy. And I was sitting in the sand, and the sand was so cool and so comfortable and so nice. And I was putting it in my fingers, and I began to think how God can whisper the most transformative, life-changing wisdom even through a grain of sand, if we just open our ears and our hearts to hear. In the Bible, it says, seek and ye shall find. Knock and the door will open. So I learned a beautiful lesson there. The lesson was, we are so much like sand. When the same exact sand, when it was in the midday sun, it was violently hot. The same exact sand, when it had a particular mixture of water in it, it was deadly quicksand. And now the same sand, in another environment, is so comfortable and so cool and so soothing, and there's hundreds of people just enjoying sitting in the sand and having picnics and everything like that. So what we associate with in the environment around us very much influences how we think, what we do, what we speak. And for those of you who have children, that's obviously something very important. Who your child keeps company with is what they're going to be, is what they will become. When I was a little boy growing up in America in the 1960s, a teenager, it was a turbulent time. And I had friends who were quite unconventional. And my parents' generation, you know, the way they dressed, the way they were not, they were really worried about me. And of all my friends, one really knew how to talk to my parents really nicely, and his hair was cut really nicely. And my mother and father used to say, you should make all your friends like Steve. But little did they know that Steve was corrupting all my other friends in me. I can't tell you all the things. So things are deceiving sometimes, especially Steve in those days. But we know if our children are drug addicts, they're going to probably take drugs. If they're with robbers, they're going to become robbers. If they're people smoking cigarettes, they'll probably smoke cigarettes. Our company so much affects us. My guru, Srila Prabhupada, he gave an analogy. If you put a iron rod in fire, it will become red and hot like fire. If you put the same iron rod in ice, it will be cold as ice. Because what we associate with, we become so influenced by that. By associating with people that drink, people become alcoholics. By associating with the Alcoholics Anonymous, people can break their alcoholism. Association is important. And from a spiritual perspective, the very foundation of every spiritual tradition, from every religion in the world, is what's called in Sanskrit satsang. In the Bible, we see some simple fishermen. Just by the company of Jesus, they became saints. Tomorrow I'm going to Udupi. It's the fifth parayaya of Pejuwar Matswami, something very historical. But we see in the example of Sripad Madhvacharya, just by his company and the company of people who had his company, millions of people's hearts were transformed. So satsang is important. Associating with saintly people or associating with people who value saintly qualities. Like the sand. Certain situations, if we have the right guidance, the right values, certain situations can make us envious, can make us angry, can make us depressed, can make us arrogant. Or certain situations can actually help us to humble ourselves before a higher power. The same situation, according to our values. So in order to actually sustain integrity and compassion, we need support. Our spiritual practice, what we choose to read, who we choose to connect with in our social lives is very much going to affect that. If you have a strong foundation, even when the storms come, we remain firm in our values. If we don't have a strong foundation, even if we build a magnificent palace, when a storm comes, it will all collapse. What is integrity? From a moral, ethical, or spiritual perspective, integrity is to sustain our sacred values in whatever circumstance may come. Because there will be temptations. Temptations that if I compromise my values, if I compromise moral or spiritual principles, I can earn so much more. That's a temptation. Or fear. If I don't compromise my values, I could lose so much. So much of my reputation, so much of my wealth, so much of my property, so much of my power. And then we have to ask, what is real wealth? Is real wealth in things, or is real wealth in our consciousness, our integrity? And this is really the test of true humanity and the spirituality of any society. Do people value that their real wealth is their character? Or do they value that their real wealth is what they have as far as things? There's a saying that a evolved society is where people use things and love people. But a morally bankrupt society is where people love things and use people to get them and keep them. And where there's so much passion and greed around, it is actually very difficult to maintain integrity. But some of the most successful people I've met in the world, some of them are sitting right here today, they live by the principle of integrity. They have boundaries they will not cross. Whatever the temptation, whatever the fear, simply because they understand what is truly of value. Because really, what are we looking for? The Brahma Sutra tells that anandamayo bhyashat, the nature of the Atma, the soul, in everyone's heart, is it is seeking pleasure. Whoever we are, whatever our race, whatever our caste, whatever our sex, whatever our nationality, whatever our religion, whatever our species, everyone is looking for pleasure. Everyone's trying to avoid pain. But what is pleasure? These are basic questions. Things can give some pleasure to the body and senses, and things, that means fame, power, money, sex, entertainment, things could give some mind pleasure to the mind and senses, but things can never give pleasure to the heart. There's only one thing that can give fulfillment to the heart. That's love. To love another and to feel loved by another. And according to the great spiritual traditions of the world, the origin of that love is God's love, who we call Krishna. Krishna's infinite, unmotivated, uninterrupted love for us and our natural propensity, our potential to love God. And what is the nature of that love? The Srimad Bhagavatam tells, if you water the root of the tree, that water will extend to every part of the tree. Similarly, when we actually offer our love to God, when that awakens within our heart, who is janmadyasya yataha, the root, the cause of everything, sarva karana karanam. It's like watering the root of a tree. You can't love God and not love anything. We may not love what people do, but we love them. Because we understand beyond their conditioned mind and senses, wherever there's life, there's the Atma, there's the soul, there's a part of God, there's our brother, there's our sister. The Bhagavad Gita tells what real wisdom is. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmani kavi hastini suni chaiva svapake cha pandita samadarsha. That when we actually understand who we truly are, the eternal spirit, the Atma, that's giving life to this body. Nahanyate hanyamane sarire, that is not subject to birth or death. We are driving in a car. We may have a Ford. We may have a Volkswagen, we may have a BMW, we may have an Ambassador. We have to trade in our cars eventually. But that's not the end of our life. So similarly, this body is like a vehicle that we're seeing through and tasting through and hearing through. And when this body dies, the soul continues according to our actions, according to our karma. We take another body. And actual investing in life into the future is knowing that my happiness and distress is very much based on the quality of how I'm living now, both in this life and beyond this lifetime. So when we actually connect to our own soul, when we actually connect to that love that we're seeking, then we will see every living being with equal vision. Our love will extend in the form of compassion. There are different levels of compassion. There's social compassion. There's family compassion to our own loved ones directly at home. There's humanitarian compassion. There's compassion for life itself. And the more our compassion actually expands to be inclusive, the more it's truly coming from our souls. To be an instrument of God's love is for all levels, for the body, the mind, the soul. And that compassion is real wealth. I was recently speaking at the Mumbai Stock Exchange about Arvind Mafatlal. We have his son here, Rishikesh, his daughter, Maithili, his son-in-law, Srinathji for Narendra Desai, his granddaughter, Gaurangi, and Nupur. Such a family. And his values so much affected all of these people to live with such integrity and dharma. It's beautiful. Even people like Gauranga, who's a sadhu, and myself, a little swami, we really honor. More than most sadhus or swamis, these people have spiritual integrity. And he was very powerful in the business world, in the industrial world. He met his guru, Ranchor Maharaj, and he understood that the most valuable thing in life is how he could serve. Seva. Seva means unselfish service that's actually for the pleasure of God and for the well-being of others. And when he passed away a few years ago, people loved him. Not because of how much money he had, not because of his business brilliance, or not because of the corporate accomplishments he made. People may be impressed by those things, but they loved him because of his compassion. Moved their hearts, transforms lives. There's nothing more valuable. Yad yad acharati sreshtas tad tad evitarojana. The Gita says, what prominent people do, that's the standard that the next generation is going to value. As parents, our integrity and our compassion, more than anything else, is going to affect the values of our children. And their values is what's going to give them real inner fulfillment, peace and happiness in their life. And what's going to empower them to also be peaceful, give peace and happiness to others. We have our Radha Krishna Prabhu. He was a very high-level dentist in Mumbai. And he decided to go from dental to transcendental. And when he was a dentist, he was doing good. You know, he was fixing people's teeth, and that was kind of putting him out of some suffering for a while. But now, as Sunil was saying, he's arranging food in Mumbai alone to about 300,000 children in the ghettos. And throughout India, about 1.2 million. And the schools in which these meals are being served, the principals, they're very happy because, what is it, about 30% less dropout rate? Because people leave school because they're hungry. You can't concentrate when you're hungry. Not only the children, but the parents would rather have them begging or working child labor than just going to school hungry. But you give them good meal, and they'll stay in school, and they'll learn, and they'll feel cared for and loved by the society around them. So yes, he did well as a dentist, but I believe his heart is feeling so much more fulfilled that he's helping people on this level, because it's compassion. But we don't have to give up our jobs or give up our place in society. This is the basic teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, that in whatever profession, whatever ashram, whatever varna, whatever situation we're in, if we understand basic principles, we're living a truly divine life of dharma. Bhoktaram jagatapasam saravaloka maheshwaram. To be honest, that everything belongs to the higher power of God's grace. Our bodies. We didn't make our bodies. We may say our parents made our bodies, and they were certainly instrumental, and we should give all gratitude and love to them for doing that. But they didn't really know what was going on. You know, they weren't like sitting with their computers through various graphics. Okay, now the kidneys will come, and now the heart will come, and now the eyes will come, and now we'll develop the brain. It was all just happening. Nature. God's nature. Our abilities, the air we breathe, the sunshine, the rain, Mother Earth, everything is a gift. And to actually be in harmony with ourself is to be in harmony with God, to be in harmony with other people, to be in harmony with nature, Mother Earth, and to feel a sense of gratitude. Then there's a transformation. And in that state, we understand I'm not proprietor. I'm a caretaker. Everything in this world is potentially sacred. In the Vedic literatures, the personification of all wealth is Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. That means knowledge, strength, money, property, this is all the energy of Lakshmi. Lakshmi is sacred. If we just see that this janasya mohoya mahoma meti, that this is mine and this is yours, and this is who I am and this is who you are, if we just see like that and we fall into the trap of selfishness, and we can't really appreciate the sacredness of anything. But if we have a grateful heart, if we humble ourselves before all the higher powers of the people and nature herself for what she's giving us, then we understand it's sacred. And then we can really connect with the reality, I am a caretaker of sacred property. My knowledge, my influence, whatever finances, this is God's family. I'm a caretaker. And we have a responsibility. And with that responsibility, we actually value integrity and value compassion. So yes, Aravind Mafatlal, he lived in this world, but he was not of this world. And his children and grandchildren are doing the same thing. And people loved him because they knew him. Not because of the material things that he had, but because of his compassion. And this is what's so much missing in the world. When people are motivated by greed, we see what happened at Wall Street. When people are motivated by arrogance and insecurity and fear and hate, we see what's happening with terrorism. Drug addiction, depression, it's on the rise practically everywhere. But if people have a sense of the joy of integrity and compassion, they could transcend all these things and be instruments of real positive change. Whether it's in the name of religion or business or investment or farming or education or medicine or software engineering, it's so important that we can exemplify through our lives and having the satsang of helping each other to really appreciate the value that we can pass on to the world and to the next generation. That there's nothing more precious in life than integrity. There's nothing more valuable in life than compassion. Thank you very much. Yeah, if you like.
Maharaj, your message, what you said, yadeda charati sreshtastha tadata avichara chana. We hear that loud and clear. You are our leader and we follow you. That's what you just narrated, Bhagavad Gita says. We understood very clearly the message of we need to have attitude of gratitude. I'm sure after listening to you, like me, lot of people here, they will have a lot of questions, thoughts, views. Maharaj has agreed to hear your thoughts, interaction, views, any questions. Mics, we will actually move around with the mics. So anyone has any thoughts, anyone wants to share something, please feel free.
Maharaj, you mentioned that we are now living in the period of where compassion and integrity is lacking. But when we read history, we have always repeated, it is repeated with so many instances of lack of integrity and lack of compassion. It is not just it. What is the difference between those days and today? Is it a cycle? It will always come again and again?
It's always what's most important. And whenever there's an absence of that, there's always more and more and more problems that grow from that. I was speaking just the other day. There was a eye camp. We have this every year in Barsana, which is near Vrindavan, where the greatest cause of blindness in India is untreated cataracts. So we have in Mira Road near Borivali a Bhaktivedanta hospital. And for about 25 years, every year they go to these villages where people, most of them have never seen a doctor in their lives. And we have a dental camp and a cat camp for the eyes. And we do between 900 and 1,000 cataract surgeries. And then for people who aren't ready for the surgery itself, they do some other treatment. But especially some years ago, it was pretty rough to go there. And volunteer doctors from Mumbai would go. And one particular doctor, an ophthalmologist, he has a beautiful home. He has a very lucrative practice. But somehow or other, he decided to go there. And it's kind of muddy. And it's in January or February, so it's really cold. And there's no heat. And it's austere. But he traded this old lady who was about 90 years old. She was a Brijbasi from a very remote village. And she was wearing rags, and she hadn't been able to see in so many years. And he removed the cataract and then bandaged her eye. And then some days later, he removed the bandage from her eye. And it was the first time in years that she could see clearly. She was so happy. She's completely illiterate. She's really old. And she's in poverty. But when she could see in her own very rustic village way, she took her hand and really hard was slapping the doctor on top of the head. And as she was slapping him, she was saying, "May Radha bless you with her love." Because she was so grateful that he helped her see. Now, in Mumbai, if somebody beats you on the head, it's not considered a blessing. But that's the way she was blessing. And he was standing there weeping. It was the deepest experience of his life. Limitlessly more valuable than all the money he was making, all the prestige he was getting, was that he helped this old lady and he didn't ask anything in return. And after every year after that, he comes to do that and brings his whole family. It's the highlight of his year. And for 2 weeks, he has to close his practice down. So what's really valuable? Yes, when we lose that compassion, para dukkha dukkhi, it is said. An evolved human being is one who another person's happiness is my happiness and another person's suffering is my suffering. That's the standard. And that is a life of real fulfillment in whatever field we're in. And wherever that's absent in any time in history, it not all, we're empty inside. I sometimes use example of a little girl. I've seen a little girl like this. It's America. Her parents are multi-millionaires. And they both work like anything. And the child is wearing beautiful clothes. She's about 8 years old. She looks pretty. But she lives in misery. Because she's lonely. She just wants to be loved by her parents. Nothing can give her real happiness unless she feels that love. But they don't have time. They don't have time to even see what's happening inside of her. That's the way we all are. When we're empty inside, whether we're world leaders in whatever profession we're in, if we're empty inside, then that's the way we're going to affect other people. And it's so important that we understand if we have wealth, if we have power, if we have influence, we have a huge responsibility to make the world a better place. And that requires integrity and compassion. The distractions are there. The difference between today and other times is it's like a global community now. Whatever we do anywhere in the world, we can really affect everybody everywhere. And we see, internet can have incredibly good benefits, but internet can have really, really corrupting effects too. Yes? A greedy person, a hateful person, can spread his message to the whole world, to millions of people with the touch of his finger. They couldn't do that 100 years ago. A good, kind, generous, loving person, a person with real wisdom, can also spread that message. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Is there any other questions? Yes.
Is there an inherent conflict between wealth creation and industrial growth on one hand and integrity and compassion on the other hand? And
can you say again?
Is there an inherent conflict between wealth creation and industrial growth on one hand and compassion and integrity on the other hand? And I'm not saying there will not be exceptions, but the examples that you see around are very few where there is integrity and wealth creation in harmony. There are very few examples of that. And if I think about compassion, during my childhood, there was no television, there were no laptops, there was no Facebook, there was no WhatsApp. Yeah, but I think there was a lot more compassion because we used to meet, we used to play, we used to study together. Today, if you see, it's all on technology, whether on Skype, there's hardly people meet. Yeah? Even when you wish somebody on a birthday, it's just a WhatsApp message. So I'm just trying to figure. So there are two issues here. One is wealth creation and integrity. Is there a harmony there? Very few examples. And on compassion, are we moving away from compassion with the whole technology development and wealth creation? I think these are two different questions.
Is a knife good or bad? If a knife is in the hands of a thief, he'll cut someone's throat, kill them, and rob them. If that same exact knife is in the hands of a surgeon, he will save a person's life. So everything in this world, influence, power, money, wealth, even knowledge, you know, if you could use your knowledge, the most crooked people in the world usually have a lot of knowledge. They just use it for their own selfish purposes or their own hateful purposes. So everything has a potentially divine purpose or corrupt purpose. And the field of earning wealth is very much like that. What are we doing it for? If we have a value of why we're earning wealth, it doesn't mean we're going to be less competent. In fact, we might be more competent. Do you know the story of Mahabharata? On one side is Duryodhana, and on the other side is Arjuna and Yudhisthira. If you read about the battle of Kurukshetra, they were doing the exact same thing. Duryodhana was on a chariot. Yudhisthira was on a chariot. Duryodhana had clubs and bows and arrows. Yudhisthira had clubs and bows and arrows. They were both fighting. And they were both fighting as hard as they could fight. They were both organizing the military formations. They were both doing diplomacy to get people to help them. But the difference is Duryodhana and Arjuna was doing it for the true well-being of all living beings. They were not doing it out of ego or selfishness. They were doing it with compassion. And how hard did Arjuna fight? He didn't fight less hard than Duryodhana. Duryodhana, he was motivated by greed, selfishness, and envy, and arrogance. And for a while, he was winning. He exiled the Pandavas to the forest for 14 years. But this lesson of Mahabharata is very important, that we can't always see things by the immediate how it appears. Because Duryodhana really seemed that his envy and arrogance was a superior strength than Yudhisthira's compassion and dharma. But in the end, Yudhisthira was victorious. So they were both performing their duties with equal passion. It's not that Arjuna was less productive because he was on the side of dharma. When we actually have compassion, we'll work harder than a person with greed because we have such a deeper purpose in doing what we're doing. And it's just very important that even if there's just a few examples of this, when individuals like us, and actually even in religious life, it's the same thing. There's a lot of arrogance and greed and hate in religion too. What to speak of business and politics. On every level, Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. And if even if a few of us make that decision, we can have a big effect on the whole world. My beloved guru, Srila Prabhupada, 50 years ago from this year, he left Vrindavan and went to America. He was 70 years old when he arrived in America on a cargo ship of 38 days overseas. He had no money. He didn't know anyone. And within a few years, he had tens and thousands of followers, about 100 temples, and was publishing and distributing tens and millions of Vedic scriptures, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Upanishads. And he came back to Mumbai, and he was meeting people of the business and investment world. And he said to them, I'm one Indian. I'm just one little Indian man who went to the West at 70 years old with nothing. And now there's tens and thousands of people who are really striving to live with integrity and striving to live with compassion and striving in a spirit of real dharma, sanatana dharma. What could all of us do if we work together? We can make a big difference. Where there's the greatest necessity, there's the greatest opportunity to serve. So there's different ways of seeing. When we see that so much of the world is going toward just chasing after by any means, we have to get what we want. That just gives us an indication of how important it is that individually and collectively we make a difference. And my experience is when we really are trying to make a difference like that, it's incredible that we discover how many more people really are also doing that. All over the world, especially in India, but in Europe, in America, there's a lot of people who really see the way the world is going and they really understand we have to be that change. When I became a vegetarian in India in 1970, I went back to the West, and believe it or not, in America in 1972 when I came back, I couldn't meet anybody who even knew what a vegetarian was. You know, what's a vegetarian? It says we don't eat meat. It says, then what do you eat? My father was completely, and my mother, when they found out I'm not eating meat, they thought I was going to die. My mother got vegetarian cookbooks and was cooking vegetarian just because of her motherly love. But they really were worried about me. They thought, he's going to die. He's not getting protein. And then my father went to his doctor, who was really a good friend of his, a very top doctor. And he said, what am I going to do about my son? He's going to get sick. He's going to die because he doesn't eat meat. And the doctor looked at him. He says, I eat meat. But as a doctor, I can tell you absolutely 100% he's going to live longer than all the rest of us. Because that's the healthiest diet from a medical perspective. I'm always planning to become a vegetarian, but I'm just habituated and I go on all these social parties and and today, that was in 1970. Today, there's tens and millions of people who are vegetarians and vegans. Not just for health, but because they're actually feeling compassion for other living beings. For humanity, and for animals as well. So it's actually quite amazing the type of polarization and the type of enlightenment that actually is happening in the world today on many, many levels. It's incredible how many environmentalists there are in the colleges of the West. That's the buzzword of Western colleges, is environmentalism and ecology. Because people see, what is the fate of our world with all of this exploitation? We have to honor Mother Earth. Gauranga Ji and our team are developing an eco-village. And in January and February, there's 350 people coming from the West to come and live there. Because they really want to make a difference. And they want to learn, you know, practically about these principles. And actual environmentalism cannot really have substance unless it's based on compassion. Because what we do to the earth is what we do to every living being on the earth, because everyone's dependent on the same resources. I don't remember your question, but I hope I answered it.
Do you believe that these are also related with reference to time, context, and environment? Or are they absolute in its context?
The principle of where integrity and compassion comes from is constant. It comes from having gratitude and being nourished with love and wanting to nourish others with love. But the application of the actual expression of compassion and integrity naturally will change with the time and the place and the people and the circumstance. You know, after an earthquake, compassion is going to take a particular form. When a person's in a hospital dying, compassion is going to take another form. When we're trying to educate young people to actually live a fulfilling, meaningful, and compassionate life, that's another way of expressing compassion. So if we cultivate that spirit within ourselves, then according to the relative circumstance that we're in and the people we're with, it will be expressed in various ways. We chant God's name in our tradition to actually tap into that compassionate spirit that's within all of us, and to really have a dynamic, enthusiastic, determined way of expressing that compassion according to the particular field that we're living in. A mother's compassion for child, that compassion doesn't make her lazy. As far as I've seen in my life, mothers work harder than anybody. You know, when mothers have baby or two babies, they don't have a 9-to-5 job. If the baby's sick, the mother's up all night. Yes? The mother will do anything. A loving mother will give her life at any moment for the welfare of her child, because there's love. Compassion does not make us lazy. That's a fable. That's a way that people try to justify greed. That if I'm unselfish and compassionate, if you are like that or I am like that, it will make us non-competitive. We will not perform properly. We have to have greed and arrogance to perform properly. That's just a very, very unfortunate lie to justify not changing. The reality, take a mother for example, she'll work 24 hours a day with total devotion because she loves her child. If we have love for humanity, and by raising funds to help projects for humanity, we will be more motivated by anybody than anybody who has greed. But for a purpose that enriches our lives and enriches the world, according to the circumstance. Actually, you are all already like this, and I'm just a little Swami, but you asked me to speak, so I'm sharing these ideas. And I'm not trying to tell you anything or preach to you anything. I'm just, those values that you already have, I'm just speaking these things just to encourage you, to encourage myself as well, to really to worship those values, to recognize and appreciate those values, to be an instrument of the higher power of God's grace is a beautiful life.
Thank you very much.